I need another board in here. So I put my map on the bottom over here because I'm thinking, everybody, of course, knows the map. Everybody knows where everything is. You know, it comes to your mind quickly. So when I say the Levant, that's the area that's on the east side of the Mediterranean Sea, borders east side of the Mediterranean, called Levant. Sometimes it's called Syria. Sometimes it's even called Phoenicia. But I've been using Levant because it describes the whole area. Syria describes the whole area. And then we divide that into two sections. The northern part would be Lebanon, is French, Catholic. And then, I mean, in terms of how we think of it, then we have the British, where Israel is, except that's what we're discussing. And then we have Egypt, which is a British-held territory, or, you know, they're, that's not quite the way you say it. It's one of their client states. What? The dividing lines between French and British. It's probably around the Galilee. It actually ends up being north of, but in these discussions, it's sort of at about Haifa. Okay. So anyway, that's the map. And I've had 2 weeks of introduction. I could do three more introductions, but I finally got to get to the lesson. Get to the lesson, which will, if I do the introduction, you have something to deal with, because introductions are really part of the lesson. And remember, we're talking about why this is so important. We have a, quote, once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to see God at work in tangible, objective ways. When God said back in the days when he created the world, he said, let there be light, the same power that said that and caused the world and its universe to come into existence is the same word, the same power that says to Abraham, I'm going to give you this land. Same power. All right, so we have, I give you this land, that's on the left-hand side. I give you this land is repeated many times in the book of Genesis. And as it goes into the next generations after Abraham, they repeat it again. I give you the three passages where it comes down even to the end of Genesis, where it actually uses these words, I give you this land. Then we wait for 4,000 years before God actually gives them the land. Now, they've been in land before, that's true, but they've been out of the land. So when we say, when I will bring you into the land, Ezekiel 36:24, that means to stay. That means to stay. Now, in the meantime, we have also in Ezekiel 36, verse 2, God is talking to the nations, because the enemy has spoken against you, Israel. Aha! The everlasting heights, the land, have become our possession. So the world nations have claimed the land that God gave to Israel. And we say, oh, I thought that was new. No, it goes back a long time. So again, if you can grasp the importance of this time, is that the land was given in 1948, the beginning of the nation. It was the beginning of the nation when God says, I will bring you into this land. Now, the bringing into the land is going to be by phases. They're not going to come in as an obedient people, but they're going to come in as his people, the descendants of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. All right, so I think it's interesting that the people, the nations around Israel have said, aha, the land has become ours. And God says, not a chance. Not a chance. So we have Abraham on one side, and Ben-Gurion on the other side, making the announcement in Tel Aviv in the day of May 14, 1948, declaring Israel a nation, recognized within 10 minutes by President Truman and another 15 minutes by the Russians, and they are now have international status, recognized as a nation. Within a year, they're adopted into the UN as a qualified nation. A little bit out of Ezekiel, and you, son of man, prophesy to the mountains of Israel and say, O mountains of Israel, hear the word of the Lord. Thus says the Lord God. Here's that verse. Because the enemy has spoken against you, aha, that's what they've said. The everlasting heights have been our possessions, they have said. Therefore, thus says Lord God, surely in the fire of my jealousy I have spoken against the rest of the nations, against all Edom, who appropriated my land for themselves as a possession with wholehearted joy and with scorn of soul to drive out the Jews. Therefore, prophesy concerning the land of Israel. Say to the mountains and to the hills, to the ravines, to the valleys, thus says the Lord, behold, I have spoken in my jealousy, in my wrath, because they have endured the insults of the nations. The Jews have endured the insults of the nations. Therefore, thus says the Lord God, I have sworn that surely the nations which are around you will themselves endure their insults. But you, O mountains of Israel, you put forth your branches and bear your fruit for my people, Israel, which is, I think, already fulfilled. Then the next phrase, for they will come soon, would mean those that are the believing remnant of Israel. So even as we sit there, we could still say the Jews will come soon, not the unbelieving. So that's what I think is referenced here. This is about the Jews. When they came to the nations, where they went, they profaned my holy name, the Jews did, because it was said of them, these are the people of the Lord, these are the Jews, yet they have come out of the land. But I had concern for my holy name, my promise over here, for which the house of Israel had profaned among the nations, where they went, they have not been faithful. Therefore, say to the house of Israel, thus says the Lord God, it is not for your sake, Jacob and Isaac and Abraham, not for your sake, O house of Israel, that I am about to act, but for my holy name, which you have profaned among the nations where you went. I will take you from the nations, gather you from all the lands, and bring you into your own land. Not because of the promise God made to Abraham per se, but because of God's word is why he's got to do this. And we have a whole group of people that says God, Abraham misunderstood what God meant. All right, so that's my background for today. All right, we talk about beginning of our little story here. Goes with this chart. Before World War I, Armistice, Lord Arthur Balfour, they say, the British Foreign Secretary to Prime Minister David Lloyd George, desire to gather encouragement for a homeland for the scattered Jews. Balfour began to seek support from a key sympathetic nation, the United States, something he felt was essential to the idea. Remember that Theodore Herzl established Zionist Hope in 1897. For this purpose, Balfour did travel to visit with President Wilson, April 1917, to solicit his support. While Wilson personally supported the idea of enthusiasm, it seems, he did not feel that he could be public about it. However, for Balfour, this soft commitment was enough for him to return to England with the assurances that even if informal, were enough to begin the process of revealing British intentions. To this end, Balfour sent a letter to Jewish leader Lord Rothschild stating Britain's intention, which has famously been called the Balfour Letter, November 2, 1917. 1 year later, after the armistice, World War I, November 11, 1918, Great Britain, France, Italy, Japan, and the United States, as a neutral observer, met at Versailles, France, for the peace conference, ending in June of 1919. Since this was the last thing on the agenda at Versailles, the conferees made no effort to divide the assigned the land of the Levant, Syria. Later in London, and I have my dates up there, you have the Versailles, then you have London, then you have the San Ramos, and then you have the Lausanne conference. You got to kind of pick your way through that, but they're in the order there. Many conferences in order. So later in London, which is the next one, the same nations accepted the very language of the Balfour Declaration and assigned it as a mandate to Britain. Remember, the letter was a dead letter on Lord Rothschild's desk unless it was picked up and put into some international form recognized by other international nations. And the ones that had to recognize it are those that took the spoils out of World War I. They're the only ones that had the authority to do this. This is why it becomes now international law. Later in London, same nations accepted the very language of the Balfour Declaration, assigned it as a mandate to Britain, who was to oversee the development of a homeland for the Jews. Later, gathered in San Ramos, April 1920, to finish settling the territories. So the story, this is the way we've been told the story, but I've taught it, so the story of Israel's pre-birth has been understood, presented as a fine-tuned miracle that happened in close quarters. Only the British and the American expressed support for Jewish homeland. But as God would have it, it was enough to start, this is the way we've been teaching it, but it was enough to start the turning of the international wheels. While we believe that the establishment of a homeland, even a state for the Jews, was a miracle, the larger miracle was not in the agreement of England and the United States, whose leaders had a Christian orientation, thus pro-Israel, but it is a miracle of another kind, perhaps even more astounding. This is the piece of lost history that we turn to. So the question again, who owns the land? It is usually discussed on the basis of historic rights, moral rights, biblical rights, and some talk about international law. Consequently, there are discussions about the guilt of the atrocities, which would have to do the moral law and other inhumanities, and the years of occupation, it would talk about historic rights, by various people. I have to admit, on the front end, it is impossible to determine the answer based on anything but biblical rights. Yet the historical rights, the moral rights, the rights granted by international law all agree or all argue that Israel has the right to the land by every avenue of inquiry. In fact, I'm doing a paper on that. Maybe when we're all done with this, I'll show you that, because that is something that always comes up. They claim to these moral rights, the historic rights. Very few people ever look at the biblical rights, and if you look at the biblical rights, we find that Ishmael has been substituted for Isaac. So anyway, that's how it goes. So my discovery on this subject was by a paper written by Martin Kramer, and it was written on the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration given in 1917, so 2017. The title of the paper is The Forgotten Truth About the Balfour Declaration. I gave you the title for it. Some of you maybe have read it. For now, for time, we leave the important details of how Zionism came to be a Jewish and Christian hope in the last days of the 19th century. Talked about all that with the Dreyfus Affair and the Damascus Affair. We're not going to get into that. We're going to talk about that. But we accept it as Zionism is already in place. Now, it was in the capable hands of Theodor Herzl, and he died at age 44. And so there is a little bit of a sag there, and somebody comes along to pick up the slack. So we must mention Chaim Weizmann, who succeeded Herzl, not in the same office, but as a leader, who succeeded Herzl after his early death as a Zionist leader. Weizmann saw the entire history of Zionism from its beginning to independence. He ended his day as the first president of the State of Israel, died in 1952. Weizmann's scientific assistants, acetone for explosives, to the Allied forces in World War I brought him into close contact with British leaders, enabling him to play a key role in issuing the Balfour Declaration of November, in which Britain committed itself to establishment of a Jewish home in Palestine. Well, we'll need this later to close the loop. Just wanted to mention that here. But when checking the Jewish virtual Jewish site, the list of notable people, including relating to Zionism, there is one often missed. His name is Nahum Sokolow, and he's on my list there. But before we discover him, we need to say something about the Balfour Declaration as it has been hotly contested in history. Now, as the story goes, even though the language of the document was carefully crafted and debated over time by the British leadership, apparently deliberately, the wording, its final form has received severe criticism for its clarity, what it claims, and for its ambiguity, which is what it doesn't claim, and for a lack of rationale. There's no reason given in the Balfour Declaration why they should go there. That's the rationale. And I might say at this point that didn't need a rationale because everybody knew what it was. It's the Jewish homeland. But it wasn't given in the Balfour. So, without that whole thing, it seems kind of suspicious and has dark intentions. All this leads a noticed British Arabist Elizabeth Moore to suggest that the Balfour Letter is one of the greatest mistakes of British history. So we have what can be called a perfect storm, sides that see reality differently. A document written to bring clarity to the situation only seems to muddy the already churned up waters. All the Jewish leaders feared that with a gust of a political wind, their chances for a national homeland would sink into the deepest sea. And remember, the biggest opposition, I think, that the Jews faced was from within their own people. There were Jews that were anti-Zionists. But again, this is not quite the whole story. What we know has not been the wrong story. It is that it lacks the salient details. Again, no less a miracle, but more likely a grander one. Another established point about the Balfour, the document as presented to Lord Rothschild, bore no international, told you this, or even British Parliament's weight. It only made clear the intention of the Prime Minister of Britain's government. That's all it was, useless piece of paper. And it goes like this, part of it, His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people and will do their best, use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object. Then it goes on. So then, in 1.5 years later, at the Versailles Peace Conference began, although the senior statesmen stopped working at the Versailles Conference on this question in June 1919, the formal peace process did not really end for another 4 years when the Treaty of Lausanne was signed. After Versailles, another conference, a continuation of the Versailles agenda, the Allied powers met in London, that's the next one on the board, 1920, where the international body decided, among other things, to put Palestine under the British authority. See, these things all have to be decided. We see how they are. And they weren't that way from the beginning. They didn't have British assigned. They could have assigned Russia. They could have assigned France. But it was just obviously it had to be British. I mean, and this is a whole story. Why the British? We're not going to talk about it. We don't have time. Then a few months later at San Ramos, same year, the Allies confirmed, here, the incorporation of the statement of the Balfour Declaration to establish a Jewish national homeland. That's where it gets introduced into international document, which gets accepted by international powers, becomes international law. So the San Ramos Conference continued the work of Versailles as an international body. It set borders for the land left by the World War I belligerents. The conference was attended by the Allied parties, Great Britain, France, Italy, and Japan. The United States did not declare war on Turkey, therefore were observers, had no say in the fight. But they were there. The Balfour Declaration language was picked up verbatim in these documents. They were publicly stated, and thus by the authority of the victorious Allies, the language of the Balfour Letter achieved the status of international law, first at the San Ramos Conference and repeated again until the final adoption at Lausanne, all post-World War provisions. Now that is, if you're going to argue something from a human legal standpoint, there's no doubt who owns the land. Over the years, Jews and non-Jews have weighed in on their support for Israel and support of the Arabs. Some have discounted the Balfour, and some have put all their weight in what UN did in 1947, partitioning the land, which they never did. That was a resolution. They had no power. So it's interesting that our author, Mr. Kramer, says about these historians, few of the celebrants or the protesters to history will have much understanding of what produced the Balfour Declaration, which should not be surprising. Even historians cannot agree, which assures that almost no one who hasn't studied the history of it is likely to have a clue. No one is to have a clue. But as we know, protesting does not need a sense of history. They do it all the time. I hope we don't. So we begin with a very important, unanswerable question, typical when we encounter the work of God. And by the way, that's what we're doing. We're not talking about politics here. We're talking about what God is doing to make good his word. And so it's complicated. Yeah, I think it is. Now, I have thought, God said, let there be light, or whatever he created the world in one word. He created the world. And I thought, that was probably the easiest thing he ever did. What was hard for him to do was now to put all these people that had their own individual wills that go in 35 million zillion different directions to make them all head down the road to the same place. That would be the hard part. All right, so we have, in this case, the work of God in the nation as it relates to the promise to Abraham. We got this herd that's been released. It's got to somehow be corralled into a lined up pattern to achieve the event that God intends at the end of it. I mean, working with inanimate things is one thing, but you work with people that have wills, that's another thing. So I don't know if God is ever stressed by anything, but if he ever was stressed, it's got to be at the point where he tries to make people do his will. I'm sure for God, it's not a problem. But my point, for you, it would be really difficult. All right, just try to run your own family sometimes, find out how hard it is to get them together. Okay, in the case of the work of God in the nations, as it relates to the promise of Abraham, I will give you this land, and confirmed many times to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, even throughout the New Testament. So the conventional question, not necessarily biblical people, is why do the nations care about the Jewish people anyway? And then why now? Now, if you hear a little echo from our other lesson, that'd be good because I have talked about this before. So here we go again. They have not had a homeland since 70 AD. The last you could count them would be in 135 when Hadrian kicked them out of Jerusalem. And not out of the land, but out of Jerusalem. They have not had an independent nation since Nebuchadnezzar, 586. It is true that Jews, for many reasons, have piled up in Western Prussia or Western Russia or Prussia in Poland and in the United States, that's where the two main groups are. Why this sudden interest? The last pogroms were in Russia in 1881, way before World War II and the Jewish Holocaust. Why now in the midst of World War I? And it's really started in 1914, this real push. Of course, the historians would never give even tacit credit to God to move nations. And I don't want to say, well, God did it, and I don't care how he did it. No, we can do that, but I have more interest. So we could, of course, God does use the desires of the nations to do his bidding. That's why I'm interested. How do you do this? So we got to look for reasons. Is a fair game for us. We can do better than just say, well, God did it and go on. But if that's good for you, that's good for me. But not good for me. Got to know more. Because when we see what God has done, it glorifies him more. Okay? All right, so we too must guess, make some guesses as to why the allied world at this time would have any interest in the Jewish people. And we say, unless God's advancing clock demands it. But that doesn't tell us how yet. It just says it's time. And it seems to be that's the case. Now's the time. But how? But why now? What national self-interest is in play? What one speculative answer is that it would be in the interest of the Jews that World War I would be fought to a victory, not left in some long-lasting stalemate. Now, they say it's of interest to the Jews. And I come back and say, who cares what the Jews think? Aha. Thus, the Jewish influence would be felt in Russia and the United States pushing towards total victory. But even our author has a hard time with that answer that, you know, just, well, they just, the Jews will want it to end. So why? So how could the Jews exert such an idea? Why? What standing do they have amongst the nations? On the surface, it seems preposterous. They don't have any power in the nations. They don't have emissaries. They don't have what you call ambassadors. They don't have a head of state. They have no government. They're just people living in other nations. So how is it that they have all this power that they're afraid of or they have to kneel down to? So it seems on the surface preposterous, our author says. But then, of course, there is, in support of that idea that they have all this power, the fantastic notion that the Jews ran the world. Now, I got to stop here. How many of you, no hands, but how many times have we not heard that statement? The Jews run the world. They run the banking system. They run the Illuminati. They run everything. All right? But they don't have a nation, but they run everything. You know, it's a false thing, but it was believed. Okay, that's where we're going. So this was described in the Protocols of the Elder of Zion, written in 1903 in Russia about the Jews. Widely distributed, I get ahead of my story. Here is the divine irony. The Protocols of the Elders, a vociferously anti-Semitic document, read worldwide, supported by Henry Ford, and others presents the Jews as the one who ruled the world, sacrificed Christian children, and left unchecked will produce the most corrupt civilization imaginable. All of this was made up, but it did represent the Jews as having global power, who could change world events. Thus, the idea that the Jews could be curried to influence the Allies to stay with the war makes some sense if you believe the lie. So the irony is this: that which man meant for Jewish destruction, the protocols, God turned into a good. Confused by the protocols, the Allies are assuming more Jewish power than they really had. In the strange turn of events, believing the protocols was used to move the Allies to act in their behalf, in their favor, producing their homeland. Now, to this point, Kramer says, we, the Jews, have suffered for the protocols. We have suffered for it. But it is not wholly without its compensations. That's marvelous. It's just marvelous. I mean, we think about how the Jews suffered under it, but when these Jews suffered under it, now we're talking about national promises here. We're not talking about the individual Jew at each point. But when we talk about national promises, this is a marvelous act of God when he moves something that's a false dossier to be believed by the opponent and is used against them and used in favor of the Jews. So we suffer for it, but not totally without its compensation. It is one of the imponderabilia, of politics. You can't think it through, a politics, and it plays consciously or unconsciously its part in the calculation and the decisions of statesmen. The protocols of the elders really played a big role in Jews finding their homeland. Incredible. Now, I say, as believers, we understand that God will bring about his promises regardless of the opposition. Remember, Joseph said about his brethren's evil act, you meant it for evil, God meant it for good. Another example of it. Therefore, knowing that God acts, we may gloss over some of the underlying political reasons for British action. But we know that Buffalo and Lord George were pro-Zionist, if for no other reason than that the Bible places the Jews as owner in the land, and they all understood their Bibles, much more than people do today. This may not work for the historians, but certainly is a motivation for those who have a high view of God's superintendence of history, and these men did. Other British reasons to support the Jewish homeland: the productiveness of the territory kept the French out of Levant. And that's why I drew my map there. The British that want the French to come down into the area were British. They're not there yet, but that's where it would be. The French wanted to establish their role as, you know, remember the French Catholics and the Italian Catholics. Always, but you know, we had popes in France, three of them at one time, competing with the popes that are in Italy. Remember that story? So the French wanted to establish their role as Christian authority from Egypt to Turkey, from all the way up. That was supposed to be French territory because these are the places where the Holy Land has sites. You know how the Catholics are about places and figures and things. So the French wanted to establish their sole Christian authority from Egypt to Turkey. They wanted to be the protector of Christian holy sites in Palestine, the French. But the British had already established itself by virtue of the Suez Canal in Egypt, and in some biblical sense wished to be the champion of the underclass Jews, opposite of the protocols of elders. This may have been a factor, ? In any event, the Jewish hopes enter a very small window of time where the nations are aligned in such a way as never before. The outcome will be that the Jewish nation is born in a day just 50 years after the prophesied time given by Theodor Herzl at the First Zionist Conference in 1897. But French interests are not altogether abandoned, and they become part of the intrigue as God moves nations to accomplish his purposes. More of that later. Whatever the sum of the reasons, the British in the end required little prodding to produce the Balfour Declaration. Now we turn to Chaim Weizmann, the successor of Herzl as the first Israeli president. He will be in the end. But in the collective memory of Zionists and Israelis, there is another factor for British involvement, the pervasive genius of one man, Chaim Weizmann. The telling goes like this. Weizmann, famed biochemist and later head of the English Zionist Federation, managed single-handedly to win over British leading politicians and opinion makers to the Zionist idea. The Weizmann saga unfolds behind the scenes in London, drawing rooms with a Russian Jewish immigrant, where he came from, Russia. Having arrived in England in 1904, succeeds in persuading, some may say seducing, the likes of Balfour, Mark Scott Sykes, Alfred Milner, and Lloyd George, who would soon hold the fate of the Middle East in their hands. The Balfour Declaration is a triumph of one man's indefatigable will and his personal effect upon a handful of British statesmen. In the decades that followed the Balfour Declaration, Weizmann would go on to be a famed career as a leader, spokesman, and diplomat of Zionism, culminating his election as Israel's first president. His works firmly cemented his place in the Zionist pantheon as a man who brought forth the declaration. He died in 52. In 67, they honored him with stamps, along with Balfour. So when the whole story, fuller story of the Balfour is told, this is what we get. First, it is no longer a British imperial grab, but the outcome of a carefully constructed consensus of the leading democracies of the day. Two, the question of people making self-determination, so long a tension between Arabs and Israel, Jews today, is resolved. No longer do secret agreements among allies of World War II have any bearing on the question of the Jewish nation. These are all issues that come up in the argument. Lastly, we have what is known as the beginning of the open and public diplomacy, a new idea in the 20th century versus a throwback of thuggery and secret agreements of the 19th century. We don't know this. In fact, we have a president right now in Korea making deals. How public is this? You can't get away from it. Everything is done in front of everybody. Well, it all began with Wilson, with this theory of public diplomacy. So you argue your case publicly, you don't have to deal with private negotiations that have to be made public, and there's all this kind of criticism about that. Anyway, a minor point perhaps. Now, returning to the Balfour, correcting misconceptions from Kramer. In fact, a multiple nation input is entirely obscured by the Balfour Declaration form, the way we have understood it. The letter was written on behalf of the Majesty's government and no other. The declaration was approved by the British cabinet and no other. It was signed by the British Foreign Secretary and no other. And on the face of it, the declaration was a unilateral British letter of intent. In truth, in expressing a broad consensus of the Allies, it might even seem to as roughly comparable to a UN Security Council revolution of today. So rather than just be a small thing that the British are doing, it's basically a multi-nation on the scene, on the stage for everybody to see, like we would have in the UN today. I'm looking at my time. So how did all of this happen? Now we turn to the real figure here that we want to get to. His name is Nahum Sokolow. Today, when it was written, died in 1936. 80 years after his death, only a few historians remember Sokolow, and none has trouble to produce a scholarly biography. Well, who then was he? Nahum Sokolow was born sometime between 1859 and 1861 in central Poland, again, that the Pale area, received a traditional rabbinic schooling. He taught himself secular subjects and soon gained renown as a prodigy, which means a very smart person, a polyglot, which means he could talk a lot of languages, and a prolific writer of a vast array of subjects. In 1880, he moved to Warsaw, later assumed the editorship of the Hebrew Journal, I won't try that one, which became a daily in 1886. There, he contributed a popular column and wrote much of the rest of the paper so that his fame spread with the rest of the spread of modern Hebrew. So he was soon acknowledged as the world's most prominent Hebrew language journalist. Now, the point here is, one of the points, minor point, is you can have a nation, you're going to need a language. If you're going to be a Jewish nation, you're going to have a Hebrew language to unify people, because they all came from Russia, United States, Bulgaria, France. They came from all the world. They need to have. So he was the guy in his daily paper that went out to at least 10,000 subscribers, promoted the Hebrew language in the ears and the eyes of the Hebrew people. It was a unifying act. When some say, well, that's no big deal. A big deal. Because when you go to Israel today, you don't come into that land unless you learn Hebrew. You do not. You have to learn, as an alien, you have to come learn Hebrew. We could take a lesson of English here. But the language was important for the nation. And Sokolow, with it's not even being mentioned by our author here, provides a great, great service. Okay, so in 1897, Sokolow reported to the First Zionist Conference under Herzl. It was he who translated Herzl's utopian novel, Oitlant, Utopia, into Hebrew and gave it a Hebrew title, Tel Aviv, which a few years later became the name of the new Jewish city. So you know where that name came from. Tel is dead, Aviv is alive, so it's back from the dead. So it's a city in Israel that's back from the dead. It fits our little story here, doesn't it? So leaving daily journalism in 1906, he became the secretary of the World Zionist Organization, which was struggling after the death of Herzl. Sokolow, therefore, threw himself into lobbying, diplomacy, propaganda, traveling across Europe, America, and the Ottoman Empire. In 1911, he was elected to the Zionist Conference, 1914 in Britain. He joined forces with the dynamic young Chaim Weizmann in the campaign to win British recognition of Zionist aid, those two guys. So, the beginning of the effort to produce the Balfour Declaration begins with Weizmann. Now, we're talking about 1914, approximately. But Sokolow also given credit because he accomplished what many thought impossible. During the spring of 1917, he secured explicit and tacit assent of the French, the Italian, and even the Roman Pope to the Jewish national home under Jewish auspices. That's what's not known. So how did he surprise everyone, including Weizmann, by this achievement? Why has this been gone so long forgotten? So we leave that question till later.